You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast. My name's Chris Parr. Today we're covering the edition that covers the 2nd to the 8th of May 2013. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and David Matthews, along with books editor Karen Shook and editorial assistant for news John Elms. We've got loads to cover, more people here than usual, but four things specifically. First of all, the Times Higher publishes its inaugural Global Gender Index this week, showing the startling levels of sexual inequality among those working in academia, so we'll speak to Jack about that. We'll also be looking at the decision of an increasing number of UK universities to get themselves involved in the Academies programme, and we'll be busting the myth, perhaps, that lucrative overseas students are queue jumping ahead of UK students with better grades to gain access to universities. That's David's splash this week. Finally, we'll take a look at this week's book section. There'll also be an additional podcast, which we'll tell you a bit more about later. But first, Jack, the Global Gender Index. It's the first time we've done it. Why are we doing it? What's it designed to show us?
Well, this is a study that we've done, and it takes the information from our world rankings, the top 400 universities in the world, according to our various criteria that we publish every year. And we've actually looked in some detail at some of the at the makeup of the academic staff, and we've seen quite an interesting gender imbalance across more or less all major countries and all leading institutions, showing a major deficit in terms of women academics. And I've been looking at why this is, and there's some quite interesting studies there. I spoke to some academics from Japan, which was the least progressive of all the major university sectors that I looked at, and talking about some of the very conservative social attitudes towards women, the very hostile working environments for women who are unable to climb the ladder because they have to juggle so many personal and social commitments, along with having to do very long hours.
Is that exclusive to Japan, though? Is that only a reason why Japan would struggle?
Well, Japan was the worst offender, let's say. But other places like China was quite bad, and even places like the UK and some of the Scandinavian countries, known for being quite progressive, they were not really bringing on women in their leading universities, and they weren't there in sufficient numbers to. And it's quite interesting as well, given that the majority of students in the world are women, something like 59% of all graduates are women. But then once you get into academia, this proportion starts going down towards 30%, and then when you get into senior management, the percentage is quite, tiny, really. There's only one female vice chancellor of a Russell Group university, Nancy Rothwell at Manchester. So that sort of shows that in the research intensive universities, women are quite sort of lacking in the senior positions.
I mean, what really surprised me, actually, looking at the world map of gender equality, is actually the only representative of the Islamic worlds that we cover, which is Turkey. Is actually top. It's actually got more than 45% women as academics, which probably confounds a lot of people's expectations, perhaps.
Well, that depends on how you view Turkey. Is it an Islamic country?
Yeah.
Actually, they're sort of on the interface between Europe and the Islamic world, the Muslim world. And there's some quite interesting historical reasons for why Turkey has done so well. Actually, they're quite progressive in bringing women into their civil service. This was happening almost 100 years ago, that women were coming into the civil service, becoming leading managers in various parts of public life. So I was quite interested to find out why this was happening in Turkey, and Turkey is the most progressive of all the countries that we've actually seen in our study.
Yeah, it's interesting reading, and encouraging results from Finland and Australia as well, but I'll leave you all to take a look at that feature. It's up online, of course, and in the magazine as well. It's actually our cover feature this week, so do check it out. But we'll move to our news section now. John Elms, your debut on this podcast. Welcome.
Yeah,
you've been looking at academies to the uninitiated secondary schools, essentially state-funded, but sort of independent in the way they use their money, as it was. What have they got to do with universities, and why are more universities getting involved with them?
Well, that is a good question, and there were some that would say that they shouldn't be involved. For the universities that do decide to sponsor academies, I mean, the most pressing example is the University College London's academy, which has just opened, much heralded, lots of media coverage. I think there's a lot of social... there's a social reason why universities set up academies is because they, you know, they're trying to branch out into their local community and provide them with a more holistic education, perhaps having crossover with the universities, providing tertiary education at a certain level in secondary schools. But as Michael Wharton, Vice Provost at UCL, pointed out, it's also self-serving because sometimes pupils don't come ready, prepared enough for university life from their schools, and they want to give them a kind of a, make the wet sponge effect, have them already soaked up a bit of information. And I suppose it's progressive attitude in that if you prepare students for university life from a young age and inspire more students to go into higher education through interaction between a school and a university, then they will take that route, and higher education will be a route other than for students.
Surely they'd be encouraged to take the route towards the university that's sponsoring them, though. And the other schools do give careers advice a lot, don't they? If you're an academy sponsored by a university, which university is that academy gonna?
Well, exactly. I mean, there is that point, but you know, some of the universities that have set up these academies, UCL especially, and also King's College London, who set up a specialist math school, there's no route into that specific university if you go to the academy. However, the University of Chester Academies Trust, UCAT, which is one of the most successful multi-sponsor academy chains in the country, they actually do. It's not in the article, but when I was speaking with Jim Burke, their chief operating officer, he said that any student in one of the trust's academies is guaranteed an interview and a place at the university if they meet the requirements for A-levels.
Well, I hope this happens in addition to all the widening participation work that's happening by universities, because if you're doing it in London, you can imagine it would work. There's lots of universities, maybe each university can sponsor one school. That would only then reach a very small amount of the children in London. If you live in somewhere like Norfolk, there's only one or two universities near you, so how does this model work across the country outside of the big urban centres?
Well, quite actually, weirdly enough, Colin Hankinson, who's UCAT, the Chester Trust's chief executive, he makes the point that you actually only ever start to see the benefits of kind of the idea of widening participation and making students more aspirational from an early age if you have a chain of, say, 10 to 20 academies, and that is actually more difficult for universities in London. He said that regionality is very important. If you can build up a collection of academies in a region like Chester, then they can all, you know, it's cross-fertilisation of ideas, whereas if you're setting up the odd school here or there, it might not actually work.
Because if you think about it, actually, students in London, sixth formers can go on the tube with their Oyster card and they can visit 30 universities in a few weeks, but actually it's so much harder if you live out in Yarmouth or Penzance.
Absolutely, yeah. And certainly, as you alluded to there, Jack, plenty of very vocal critics of the academy scheme in general as well.
Definitely.
Very vocal. Certainly, sort of questions about what it does to state-funded schools and whether it's healthy to have, you know, schools operating outside of national agreements and so on and so forth. But well worth a read of John's analysis there. But our main news story this week comes from David. You've been, the headline suggests busting some myths. What's the myth about overseas students getting places at UK universities, and why don't the stats back it up?
Well, there has been this kind of long-standing suspicion that universities, for reasons of income, because they become attached with more high tuition fees, will let in international students with lower grades.
They're lucrative. So.
Yes, exactly. They are lucrative, no secret about that. And this flared up last summer. It's quite a political hot potato. The Daily Telegraph did a sort of sting on an undercover recording of a Chinese agent promising undercover reporters they could get a Chinese student into Cardiff Business School with lower grades than was advertised. And so universities kind of took quite a lot of flack over this supposed practice. However, we've crunched some numbers provided to us by a site, Best Course For Me, and what they show when you compare sort of line by line, course by course, university by university, is that there's not really any difference between the grades. I mean, on about half of them, the UK students have more UCAS tariff points. On half of them, the non-UK students have higher tariff points. So it kind of busts this myth. There are a few caveats. We've only been able to do non-UK rather than international students, so that includes EU students as well, who pay the same fees as UK students. And clearly, it's only a sample. It's the largest courses, and you know, at risk of sounding too much like an academic, more research needs to be done. Mm. But on the basis of this, this myth appears to be unfounded.
Sure, is there any evidence that it leans the other way? Perhaps that you sound there in some cases, the overseas students are the ones who are outperforming, and perhaps is there a risk they're missing out on courses because UK students are being prioritised?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Overall, it's about 50-50 split in terms of who has the higher UCAS tariffs. But at some universities, say St Andrews and LSE, that have very high numbers of international students, it's actually the non-UK students who have more UCAS tariff points. Mm-hmm. They on that measure, at least, they are more qualified than the UK counterparts. Yeah. However, of course, the LSEs say, well, the UCAS tariff doesn't actually quite match up these qualifications, so you can be equally qualified, but the UCAS tariff will give you more points, and there's an ongoing debate about whether that tariff is actually useful.
Presumably, people who are of the opinion that foreign students are being cut an easier deal to get into the country because of the cash bonus to universities will remain sceptical and call into question the qualifications of students in some countries where people feel that language qualifications have been massaged, or that it's hard to really tell what a grade from another country means. These are presumably the same people who feel that A-level grades are going up every year and can't be trusted. But the qualification that a student from India or China arrives with, even though there may be a UCAS equivalent, they may say, well, he's someone who's obtained this by false pretenses.
Well, the only things that are really included on the UCAS tariff are A-levels and international baccalaureates.
Right.
I mean, there are a few other qualifications, but generally, if you get the kind of national qualification from like Cyprus or Greece or other places, it's often not included in the UCAS tariff. So there's a really difficult to compare, actually, and it's hard to know absolutely certainly one way or the other. But
and it would be difficult to expand this kind of research because universities would cite confidentiality, presumably.
Yeah, it's quite difficult to certainly on where courses have few students, it's quite difficult to get data from that because of confidentiality. You actually might reveal how many UCAS tariff points an individual student has.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we've only been able to do the biggest, largest cohorts. Yeah.
And I think this data really highlights perhaps some of the other benefits that international students are bringing to British universities. I mean, they're obviously quite clever. Maybe they could be seen as an example for British students. You know, they've come over here, they're committing their money, they're motivated. When I was in Japan, they were saying that they were really keen to have Korean students in because they really had this work ethic that put some of their Japanese students to shame. And I wonder if that's the case here in England.
Maybe we could just charge UK students 10 times as much and see how committed they are then.
£90,000 a year.
Yeah, that would certainly bring out the commitment in me, I think. it's fascinating reading. Do check that out. That's on our main splash this week. Karen, we should perhaps come over to you now. A regular feature, although not quite as regular as I thought it was going to be when we started, but we're going to increase the frequency of our book section roundup. What have you got for us this week?
The book section this week, the book of the week, is a volume by an 83-year-old academic who is a double Pulitzer Prize winner and perhaps the preeminent Holocaust historian, Saul Friedlander. Robert Eaglestone of Royal Holloway reviews this book. The interesting thing is that Friedlander is a historian. This book is about Franz Kafka. So for those who fear that historians are trying to encroach on literary studies territory, here's a prime example of it. But Robert, who reviewed the book and who is himself a literary studies academic, feels that Friedlander has brought a lot to this. Now, a lot of people see Kafka as in some way a harbinger of the terrible cataclysms that were to affect Europe in the 20th century. He died in the 20s. Friedlander's book touches on some of the things that he shares with Kafka. They were both German-speaking Jews from Prague, and in fact the two families knew each other. I spoke to Friedlander about the book, and he says he doesn't actually feel Czech himself. He's not really sure. He's been moved so many different places in his life. Mm-hmm. And he said that he felt that Kafka's work was something that built on dreams. This touches on many of the kind of Freudian issues that he has explored in looking at the Nazis and the Holocaust. I'll be speaking to Robert Eaglestone tomorrow in a books podcast devoted to talking about Holocaust studies, about Friedlander's work, and about Robert's own work. And elsewhere in the section, we look at a new book on Margaret Mead and her participation in certain anti-Cold War initiatives with the U.S. government. Obviously, Margaret Mead, the preeminent anthropologist of the 20th century, talking about when and how women were allowed to attend debates in Parliament, in a book by Sarah Richardson, and Christina Helmich at the University of Reading, who's an important scholar in international relations looking at Al-Qaeda, is reviewing Adid Dawish's book about the Second Arab Awakening, covering the Arab Spring.
That's it. Well, as ever, a very eclectic range of topics covered. And as you alluded to there, if you are a fan of our books section, which if you're not, I can only assume you haven't read it, there is an extra podcast out this week. It's Karen in Conversation with Robert Eaglestone. So do look for that on Friday, the 3rd of May. Until then, you can talk about everything we've discussed in today's podcast on our Google Plus page, our Facebook page. You can reach us on Twitter. Of course, the website's at timeshighereducation.co.uk. We'll be back with another podcast next week. And of course, that book's one tomorrow. So do keep listening. Bye for now.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.